I tell you, the idea of brown bag seminars, you know, you'd used to back in the day, you'd get together and folks would maybe have a slideshow and they'd be able to talk a little bit about their trip. And now, of course, this whole let's present something kind of cool and slick and polished online is something that many folks have been doing for quite a while. And oh, my gosh, the pictures are going to be absolutely outrageous. David Searing is on the phone with us this morning. He is a professor with the UMD Department of Anthropology, Sociology, and Criminology, and he's doing a virtual talk about the Saraguro indigenous community in Ecuador. He's got some videos that he'll be able to show. He's got some gorgeous photographs that he shared with me to give me an idea of what we were talking about here. And Dr. David Searing joins us on the phone this morning. Hey, good morning, David. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about this a little bit. The kind of the gist of your talk is, how do you respond to the challenge of globalization? And you're talking about folks that are using art and using storytelling to simultaneously connect with their past and connect dynamically going forward in their future. That's a big concept with a lot of nuance. Give us a little sneak peek of what you'll be discussing today.
Sure. Well, that's a great encapsulation of the work that I've been doing for, I've been working with the Saraguro community for the last 15 years. And I really approach the work that I do with a sense that what anthropology brings to the world as a discipline and as an approach is a consciousness that there are just many ways to be human in the world. And I talk about that all the time with my students as we're learning. People choose to live the way that they live because it works for them, no matter where they are, and no matter what systems of the global world they're tied up in, they're still choosing the life path that makes sense for them. And anthropology is just, I'm just fascinated by that. How do people live a life that is worth living for them? What's a good life look like in different places? And what I found in working in Saraguro is that the community that's there has long been a space of creativity and creative practice in daily life. People there have to be creative to make their living. They've had to for generations and into the present. The indigenous community that's there is vibrant and alive. They do beadwork, they play music, they are some of the best farmers on the planet. They're also just creative around the question of what it is to live in the daily world. So I became very engaged by that. As an anthropologist, I enter into any community with a humble sense that I'm there to learn. And the people that I have worked with have been generous with their time and their creativity in all kinds of ways.
I'm going to ask you about this idea of cultural appropriation and some of the nuance surrounding that in a moment. But the first thing that I was really struck and interested by is when I first asked you about their beadwork in particular, you talked about how they had, in a sense, way back at the beginning, they had kind of appropriated from the global system when the very first people of their community started beading in terms of materials and this is how you do it and these are the tools you use, that kind of thing. Talk about that then, about their beadwork tradition in particular, because I know that's something that you've spent a lot of time with, and how it has changed and evolved and adapted over time, and what its role has become for the community as a whole, and also perhaps for the individuals who practice the art.
Sure, sure. That's a very central question for me. When I travel there, I spend a lot of time with a women's cooperative that does beadwork, and they've been doing it for a long time in the community. But I guess I would want to raise the issue that culture is a constantly changing dynamic process, no matter where it is. And so the Sotogoros, I wouldn't use the word appropriation, but they have seen the world and what's out there, and they have engaged with the things that interest them. So beads, for example, there's a long tradition of doing handcrafts in Ecuador and in Sotogoro specifically. The beadwork that they do now, they use the same beads that you can find from, you can go online and buy on any website. They engage with the materials that are available to them. They first started doing the particular kind of beadwork, which it's hard to imagine, but it's just like a giant, almost like a collar or a poncho, the larger ones, of these beautiful patterns that the women make in a circular round. You may have seen Ruth Bader Ginsburg always wore fancy lace collars. Some of her collars look a lot like Sotogoro beadwork. The Sotogoros first started doing this kind of beadwork when they encountered another indigenous group in Ecuador called the Shuar, who are a rainforest group. The Sotogoros started settling in part of the territory that the Shuar had traditionally held, and they had some conversations about what that was supposed to look like. And one of the things that they started doing was trading for beads that the Shuar had gotten from the global trade system as well. So seed beads, little tiny colorful seed beads. And the Sotogoro people saw them and thought they were beautiful, because of course they are. The Shuar didn't weave them. They just wore them in strands. And so the Sotogoros are from a weaving community in the highlands. And they started saying, we could do something with this. We can make something different. So they started making these lace patterns. And so that was in the early part of the 20th century, and it really kind of evolved from there into something that the Sotogoro see as traditional to them. But it's traditional in the sense that they are really good at crafting and creating art, and they saw a new way to do that, and so they took the beads and started making things from them. So it's not appropriation, it's engagement with what's in the world and elaborating on that to express something about their vision of the world.
And that's where I think sometimes it gets, and of course, if we have time, like, during a pandemic to sit and overthink things, this is something that we can, of course, overthink. But there are as you get to know different kinds of people and see different kinds of artwork and have different kinds of experiences, if you're the kind of person who enjoys handcrafting, there is frequently a temptation to say, oh, I'd like to learn how to paint like that, or I'd like to learn how to do that kind of beadwork or whatever. If you are a white person now, I hope, and have have been paying attention a little bit to what's been going on, you stop and say, well, is it appropriate for me to ask, may I learn to do this, or could you show me how to do this? There seems to be a little bit of we have kind of a governor now on our former freedom, which is not a bad thing, to just kind of reach out and take whatever's there and adapt it to ourselves. And there's a difference between the way that works as one individual person and the way it works when it's an entire, community or group of people doing that. But that's where we kind of get into the weeds a little bit with the idea of cultural appropriation. And that's something that I gather you've grappled with yourself quite a bit. And I'd like to hear your take on that.
Sure, of course. That's a crucial question. Anthropology as a discipline grew up during an era of colonial history, and many anthropologists were complicit in that history. And so there's a legacy there that has to be grappled with. As a practitioner in this contemporary moment, I think the issue is respectful asking. So you said, you have a tendency to want to say, is it appropriate for me to ask? Well, asking is always a good, generous thing to do, especially if you're going to be willing to listen to the answers. I think that the tendency is people who are from societies that have power will say they're asking and not really listen to the answer. And so when I approach this work, it's from the perspective of I am a guest in this community, and I'm curious and interested in their lives because I think they're of value just as any human life is, and I think I have things to learn. And I'll ask a question, and I'll be told an answer that says, yes, you can go forward with this question, or no, you can't. For example, when I first started going to Sotoguro, I was invited to go with some people that I was introduced to and became friends with. I was invited to go to an event that was a political rally, that there was supposed to be some dancing. The thing about Sotoguro society is that the arts, politics, daily subsistence, those are all interwoven. That's kind of an idea that I developed in my book, the idea of La Vida Matizada, the blended life. So I was invited along to go because I was interested in the dancing, and they wanted me to come and see their performance. And I was not invited into the hall when the political conversations were taking place. And actually, the political conversations went on so long that the dancing never happened. We just sat around outside, those of us who were there for that. And that was just fine. That was the daily flow of life there. I didn't have any right to feel anything other than we were out for an evening. I've not ever been invited to the community meetings that happen where they decide community justice and community policies. And that's their decision. And I think that you have to honor that statement that says, this is a space where I'm not invited. But I am invited into spaces where they feel like they have something to teach me, or I might have something to share with them. But it's the give and take is something that is essential in any human interaction. As you know, you mentioned the idea that as a white person, am I right to be in this space? That early on when I was first going, I go every Tuesday, when I'm in Ecuador, I go every Tuesday to the women's cooperative meeting where you sit around and bead and tell stories. And it's a wonderful experience because it's everything from 8-year-olds to 80-year-olds sitting around and sharing what they have to share. At one point, I asked them, I'm very interested in beadwork. I do beadwork myself. I asked them, I noticed that many of the patterns that they were working on had a lot of black as the base. They had different colors, but they used black as the background. And I asked them, I said, why do you use black so much? And they had been laughing and talking, and they froze for a moment. Everybody got quiet. And my friend Anita, who I stay with and is my bead teacher, got very solemn, and she turned to me and she looked and she said, well, and Sotoguro people are indigenous people. Their appearance is different than mine. They're much shorter. They're just whatever. She looked at me very seriously and she said, well, we use black because we're black. And if you white people beat it, you could use white because you're white. And it was silent for a moment. And then everybody started laughing. And they just razzed me about this for weeks afterwards. Because anthropologists are curious.
Well, in every culture, there's this built-in desire to just harass the new guy.
Yeah.
The person who doesn't have a clue as to the inside joke, and you just can't help it.
Right, that's right. And they gave me a great lesson there in sort of not being quite so earnest. And then Anita said, well, we use black because it looks good with the clothes we wear. We tend to wear a lot of black and it looks good. So that's why it is. So it was a great moment to sort of undercut the idea that, oh, I'm the important anthropologist who knows the right questions to ask. I don't know diddly. And so that's just being respectful of that and acknowledging the limits of what one brings goes a long way towards not having that dynamic of appropriation be there. So.
I love what you said about being willing to listen to the answer. And sometimes that's difficult because once in a while we get told no. And as adults, we realize, wow, nobody really tells us no anymore, and we're not really good at it anymore. We used to be really good at it perhaps when we were 3 or 4 or 5, and somewhere along the line, we got out of the habit of hearing that word, and we need to learn how to accept it with sometimes a little more grace. David, your program is going to be fascinating. Now, I did receive a link here. Is this open to the public or just the university community?
Yeah, so this is part of the Allworth Institute's Brown Bag series. They've been doing this for years. It's a great series where people talk about the work that they do. international with an international focus. And those events are always open to the public. When we've been, you know, when it's been on campus, people would have welcome to come physically. This time around, it's obviously online, and it is open to the public. There is a link where you can register, so you can get the. We're running this over Zoom.
Fantastic, so and we'll get that. Yep, we'll get that posted on our website, so it'll be easy for folks to connect. And what a fabulous opportunity! Maybe you've never been able to get away to drive to the university to attend one of these presentations, and now you can do it in your jammies. How marvelous! David, thanks so much for joining us this morning. It's always
thanks,
a treat Lisa. To talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. David Searing this morning is a professor with the UMD Department of Anthropology, Sociology, and Criminology, and his Allworth Brown Bag session taking place at noon today is a conversation about the Saraguro indigenous community in Ecuador.